You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Are you moving your business to Office 365? Working in the cloud can make your life a lot easier, but getting help, well, that's another story. And that's why you should check out AppRiver. They've got the most experienced support team in the business. You'll get free US-based support from folks who care about helping you and actually know how. If you're going with Office 365, go with AppRiver. Try AppRiver services free. Visit appriver.com/kickass. That's appriver.com/kickass. And now, enjoy the podcast.
That's Joe Paterno, the winningest coach in college football history.
Dad? Did you know about Jerry?
One of Penn State's longtime coaches, Jerry Sandusky, is charged with sexually abusing 8 boys.
People think that you knew about all of it.
How come no one's talking about the second mile?
Jerry started this charity. Hundreds of children.
Thousands.
Thousands!
You should say what McQuarrie told you.
He was distraught. He didn't make sense.
People need to hear from you.
What did the kid say happened?
I didn't talk to the kid.
So who talked to the kid?
You need to step down. You need to resign before somebody does it for you.
I raised millions of dollars for this university. I have a staff and a squad that can win a national championship. You want to fire me? Try it.
We want Joe! We want Joe! We want
All these
Joe!
People should be screaming
we
about the victim,
Joe!
Not Joe.
We want Joe!
You call him a legend, then treat him like a legend.
We are Penn State.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was the trailer for Paterno, the new HBO movie that stars Al Pacino as the winningest and perhaps most polarizing coach in the history of college football, Joe Paterno. To many of the students and alums at Penn State, he was known as Joe Pa and the Wizard of Happy Valley, the legendary coach, philanthropist, and champion of education who led the Nittany Lions to 18 College Bowl victories. But to others, he was the man who at best should have done more to stop the decades of sexual abuse by his assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, and at worst may have enabled Sandusky's crimes and participated in the cover-up. Today, the director of Paterno, Oscar winner Barry Levinson, joins me to delve into the Penn State sexual abuse scandal that ended Joe Paterno's 61-year career and explain why he wanted to present the straight facts of the case without actually taking sides on Joe Paterno himself. He talks about the student riots that broke out when Penn State fired Paterno and what the film has to say about Americans' views on issues of loyalty, tribalism, and the truth. He also recalls his early days teaming up with another kind of coach, Craig T. Nelson, to form a nightclub comedy duo, writing sketches for The Carol Burnett Show, becoming a director at the urging of his mentor, Mel Brooks, and he shares behind-the-scenes stories from some of his classic films, including Diner, Tin Men, Rain Man, Avalon, and more. Plus, Barry Levinson on why he says Hollywood doesn't make films about human beings anymore, whether he'd like to make a sequel to his political satire, Wag the Dog, for the age of fake news, and how a notorious drug lord got him into his first acting class. Coming up in just a moment. filmmaker Barry Levinson is one of the most prolific and accomplished directors today. His credits include Diner, Tin Men, The Natural, Good Morning Vietnam, Bugsy, Avalon, Wag the Dog, Liberty Heights, The Wizard of Lies, and of course Rain Man, for which he won a Best Director Oscar, as well as television series like Homicide and Oz. Now he directs Al Pacino in a film about the events surrounding the Penn State sexual abuse scandal called Paterno, which comes out April 7th on HBO. Barry Levinson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, Barry, I have such distinct memories of seeing so many of your films over the years. Good Morning Vietnam, I can remember going to school the next day and reciting Robin Williams jokes from the movie. Bugsy, I think I saw three times in the theaters when I was a kid in high school, and I just thought, damn, that is what Hollywood is.
Well, that's nice.
So it really is such a pleasure to finally talk with you.
Well, thank you.
Well, you've had a very interesting path to directing because you started out acting and doing comedy, then writing movies, and finally directing. How did all that begin? As a kid from Baltimore, did you ever have dreams of going into show business?
No, not at all. Not at all. Never would have entered my mind. I'm not sure that I had any ambition, period, except my biggest ambition, in a sense, was not to work in my father's appliance store. That was my goal. I used to ask him, I said, how do you, I see you like talking to somebody about a refrigerator. I mean, like for 20 minutes, how many things can you talk about a refrigerator? And I couldn't quite get it all. So I fell into this whole thing sort of step by step. There was one time I went into the library because I got bored. You know, you hang around the hallway, you know, you got to do something. So I went into the library, and I used to have that pointed finger that said selected reading. I followed it, and it was books about broadcasting, television. And I started to read the books. So every time I had certain classes that I didn't like, I went to the library, and I kept reading about television and then radio. And then theater, you know, and then met film. And so for the entire year, of which I never showed up, I was reading everything about that. And then because I didn't take certain classes, I failed out of that college and then went to another college, and they had a course in television. And I took that, thinking, well, you know, I watch TV, mm-hmm. I listen to the radio. This should be a fairly easy course. That was my – you can understand what an academic I sort of lacked that. It's like broadcasting seems, all right, radio, TV, I'm in for that. That can't be that hard, which led to me working at a professor took an interest and got me a job working at a television station in Washington, D.C.
And is it true that the guy who took you to your first acting class and started it all ended up being the man who was the inspiration for the movie Blow?
Yes. Yeah. No, George. Yeah. And George, I mean, that's how I got into taking an acting class, because one day we were hanging out at the beach together. We became very close friends, George and I. And George said, can you give me a ride up to Hollywood because my car broke down? And I said, OK. I hadn't been up to Hollywood. I was just out in L.A. kind of wandering around. And we pulled up in front of this building, and he said, come on in. I said, well, where are you going to go? He said, I want to check out this acting class. And I said, oh, no, I'll wait in the car. And he said, no, I'll feel obligated. So I went in, and it was actually fairly exciting, you know, and all of that. And he signed up, and he said, why don't you sign up? I said, well, I don't want to do acting. He said, it doesn't matter. It'll be fun. You know, there's good-looking girls here and all of that type of thing, you know, that went on. And I finally go, all right. So he kept carrying on about it. I went up the next day, and I said to the teacher that I'd like to join. I said, but I don't want to act. And he said, but this is an acting school. I said, I just want to watch. He said, no, you can't be in an acting school and watch. That doesn't work. So I ended up joining, and then George and I would go back and forth. And then George got bored. And I kept going, and it's an hour back, you know, back and forth, et cetera, and George stopped going. And I said, George, I'm going to have to move up closer to Hollywood because this is too much driving, and you don't want to go anymore. And then I moved out, and I was trying to explain to somebody, you know, in terms of this generation. I said, you have to understand, back in those days, there were no cell phones. You know, there's no sure. – so when you left and you moved out, you're literally – you may never ever be in contact with that person again, because, and you know, you keep, you know, moving to different places and whatever, and you can't, you know, keep in contact. So within 3 months or so, I never saw George again. And then I stayed in the acting class, which led to me doing improvisational things, which led to me working with Craig T. Nelson, and we played clubs together, doing that type of thing, which led to, you know, writing sketches, and then it led to me writing and directing. And I said, but in a sense, it's all because of George. And someone would always say, well, what happened to George? I said, I never saw him again. And then in 2000, I went to the film with my wife and seeing this film called Blow with Johnny Depp. And it said, you know, 1968, you know, on the beach thing. And I go, yeah, I was in 68. I was out there. I said to my wife, we're watching it. And then I hear this, somebody guy saying, George, hey, George. And then George Young. And I go, George Young? That's his name. And my wife said, who? I said, George. I room with George. He got me into acting school. She says, no. And then we're watching the movie. And then as it turns out, he became the largest cocaine dealer in North America. And that was George.
Wow.
And so, and
every actor needs a fallback plan, you know?
I mean, it's the craziest of circumstances. And he was a terrific guy, you know. He was not like, you know, you always assume like these, you know, these guys all sort of super slick or whatever. Mm-hmm. He was a very sort of layback, easy kind of guy. And but because of him, that's how I ended up going into acting class, which literally started all of that.
Now, you mentioned that when you came out to L.A., you started a comedy duo with your buddy Craig T. Nelson. I guess comedy duos were still a thing back then. You had Alan and Rossi and the Smothers Brothers. What was your routine like?
It was not very good. We didn't do that kind of like the smart guy, the dumb guy. You know, we didn't do that kind of banter. We in a sense, what we did, they were almost like sort of sketches. In a sense, the two of us somehow in doing some type of sketch, and we would do like a 40-minute routine, and we played clubs and. You know, on Friday, Saturday night, you do 3 shows a night, you know. And we did that for a while. And the interesting thing is, I didn't want to do it, but, you know, it was a way to make some money. And Craig wanted to be an actor, and he didn't really want to do it. But we did it to just earn some money to get by on it. And it was actually very helpful because you began to, because you're doing things all the time, you begin to develop different ideas. How would you do this? How would you approach that? You know, which in a sense helped when we stopped doing that and moved on to other things.
Yeah. And he stuck with it and of course went on to star in Coach, but you decided to go into comedy writing. You and your writing partner, Rudy DeLuca, wrote for a lot of the classics, the Marty Feldman Show, Tim Conway, and then the Carol Burnett Show, which broke so much comedy ground. What are some of the sketches that you guys wrote for Carol Burnett?
The one that I remember was Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde. And so Carol was Ms. Hyde, and Harvey was Dr. Jekyll. And so when Lyle Wagner was, you know, talking to Carol as Ms. Hyde, and he really liked her, and and they're getting sort of, you know, very close to one another. And then her face is starting to twitch and change, and she's going to turn back into Dr. Jekyll. You know, so there was that kind of piece that went on, and then all of a sudden she'd run out, and then all of a sudden Harvey would be there, you know, and Dr. Jekyll, how are you? You know, it was that kind of that kind of craziness to it. But we did a lot of physical stuff for Tim Conway when he used to do the old man, you know, old man. And yeah, we wrote a lot of those very physical pieces, wandering in slow motion into everything. We did it for 3 years. And it was a great experience.
You know, I had Carol Burnett on a while back, and I have to say, I was so impressed with how that show ran like a well-oiled machine. They always stayed on schedule, never went overtime. It was pretty much a 9-to-5 job, she said. Everyone knew what their job was, and they just did it.
They were as professional a group as you're ever going to see, and Carol was extraordinary. I mean, she extraordinary how talented she would be. And if you could see, you know, it's all pretty quick. They would get the script on a Monday. By Wednesday, we had a run through with the writers to see what's not working. Thursday, they're basically blocking it and then suddenly putting on the costumes. And then you could see her the second she would put on a costume. All of a sudden, a character was emerging, and then we would shoot it on Friday.
Yeah, they were really disciplined back then.
And unbelievable.
And I think that it was the Carol Burnett Show that led to you writing what I think is your first movie, Mel Brooks' silent movie, and then you wrote High Anxiety for Mel. As I understand it, Mel Brooks became a little bit of a mentor to you, bringing you around for the filming, the editing. He wanted you around for every aspect of it, which is pretty unusual for a writer to be that involved. What did you learn from watching him?
It was great. I mean, he was so terrific. And maybe the funniest person I've ever met in my life. I mean, literally hysterically funny, just talking about things and real smart. But he had us there. We wrote every day we'd write until we had the script. And then we were there when it was being cast, and we were there when the locations and things, and every day when it was being shot, you know, we would be over by the monitors. And that's when I really began to think about, you know, directing, because when I look at something and I'd say, like, the camera's here. I wonder what happens if you do this and what happens if you do that, you know, just in my head, you know, it's like an exercise. We were there during the editing and the scoring. So it was like going to, you know, Mel Brooks, you know, film school. But he was the one who said to me, because I used to talk about the diner guys and I would tell stories and things. And he said, well, you ought to write that as a screenplay.
Really?
And, yeah. He said that. And, I wrote Diner.
Now, what happened with Diner? Because didn't the studio initially try to tell you that it totally stinks and pull it from release?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They hated it. and I'm being kind in terms of what they had to say about the film. It was like they didn't get any of it, didn't think any of it, anything worked, which is basically why the film is the way it is. Because if it would have been better in their mind, they would have asked for changes.
Mm-hmm.
But they so disliked it, they thought it was beyond repair. So they just left it alone.
Left it alone. And then what happened? Because I guess a few weeks later, it started getting great reviews and building this momentum, huh?
What happened was they put it in a couple of theaters for 1 week, took it out, and then basically never to be seen again. It was like, well, it doesn't work, and put it away. And without going through all the mechanics of what happened, Pauline Kael got to see the film, and she called and said, when is it opening? And they said, well, we don't have any plans to open the film. He says, well, and she said, I'm going to write a rave review whether or not this film is playing in the United States or not. And it scared them, and they thought, well, we got to put it in a theater in New York. And just so we won't look bad. And so they figured they can put it in there for the week and then it'll die and that'll be the end of it. And we ended up with suddenly all of these great reviews. And the film in its second week, you know, broke the house record. And that was the beginning.
Wow.
And that was the beginning. But there was never the film never played nationwide ever. No.
Really?
They went city by city because they never believed it would work. So they never had a lot of prints. They didn't print it because they thought, well, it's no good, and why bother spend money on prints? So there were not a lot of prints, and it never played in a wide release ever, but it played for a year.
Yeah, yeah, sort of a baptism of fire in how Hollywood works, I guess,
for you. I look at it this, and in the first film that I did, I got a sense of what happens in a career because it's like you do something, and it's so terrible, you're out of the business, and you do something, and you celebrate it, and all that happened in one film. It went from, this is the worst film in the world, to getting nominated for the Academy Award. All happened in 1 year. You know, we were a flop, a failure, and then all of a sudden a big success. And that was my first film.
Yeah, you were ready for anything after that.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, your next film set in Baltimore was Tin Men. I've always wondered, since you started out in comedy and you no doubt would have known this story, was Tin Men, at least in part, inspired by Rodney Dangerfield's background?
No. It was inspired by this one moment when I was shooting Diner. You know, you have an assistant director and we have extras, right? We were talking and I said, now, look, all of our young guys, you know, the diner guys are on the right-hand side of the diner and to the left is where the tin men would sit. And he said, what? I said, the tin men, the guys that sold aluminum siding, they're on the left and they'd be older. And so it stayed in my head. All of a sudden, I'm thinking about the Tin Men. And when I was finishing, you know, Diner, I kept thinking about doing a piece on the Tin Men, to me, which was sort of like the last of, it would be the last of like that Rat Pack sensibility, you know, the guys, the wheeler dealer kind of guys that would dress real, you know, flashy and fancy and, you know, that kind of, the ones that would go to the racetrack and, you know, gamble and all of that. And that's where I began to think about it, because they were there all the time. And then I thought, well, that'd be an interesting if I could explore that. And I finally got to do it.
You did, I think, 4 movies in your Baltimore quartet, like Avalon and Liberty Heights, which also addressed racism and anti-Semitism in the 50s and 60s in Baltimore. Were those things that you witnessed personally growing up?
Yes. Yeah. You know, we didn't know. It's like when you're a kid, you just assume that's the way things are.
Yeah.
You know, if you crossed Falls Road, then suddenly you went into a non-Jewish area. And basically, so no Jews went into that area. And we were the first generation that basically, you know, as teenagers, got cars to go drive. And then we started to go into other areas. And that was sort of the beginning of the cultural change. And that applied in terms of, like, you know, the Black community. And then that was the beginning of the integration of the schools, you know, that took place. But not necessarily in a sense which we've normally seen, which... that it was these different groups beginning to find one another.
Interesting.
And here's like where we didn't understand that there is a separation, or, you know, and that we always talked about dating a Jewish girl or a non-Jewish girl. And we always said that, you know, Jewish girls, you know, are always late. And the Gentile girl, they're always on time. And this was our way we looked at it. And the reality is that if you go to take out, you know, Jewish girl, and you get to the house, and then you come in, and then, well, Emily, you be down in a minute, and then you got to meet the father and the mother, and what does your father do? And you have this discussion, and all that, and then finally Emily comes in, you can leave. We said, on the other hand, if you go pick up the Gentile girl, you ring the doorbell, boom, the door opens up, she's ready to go, right away. The Gentile girls are always on time. But we never thought about is they were quick to get out the door because they didn't want us to come in. Because then they'd have to explain, Dad, this is Barry Levinson.
Right.
And so that's why they were ring the doorbell. They're ready to go. They got their coat. They're heading out the door. And so we never understood that. We just thought they were punctual.
What do you think when you go back to Baltimore now, especially after the Freddie Gray protests and the riots in 2015? Does it seem different to you?
Yes, to a certain degree. But, you know, the seeds of all of those problems were percolating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was building up.
Yeah.
You know, for all of those aspects that were building up, you know, and then they finally exploded. Look, they exploded in the 60s, 67 or 68, when they had the big riot in Baltimore. And then progress really wasn't made. And then all of a sudden, you know, it leads to where things are today.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Barry Levinson when we come back in just a moment. Hey folks, I recently had a very big milestone in my life. A few weeks ago, I decided to propose to my girlfriend, and when I did, I turned to adiamore.com for the perfect engagement ring. I shopped around for a month or two, looked online and in person, and no one beat adiamore.com for the best price and the very best quality. I even went down and met with the owner, Sam, in person, shook his hand, looked him in the eye, and talked about what I was looking for in a ring. He's a straight shooter, Sam, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who knows more about diamonds. He should, because his family's been in the jewelry business since 1950. Eventually, I decided on a stunning 3-carat oval stone in a beautiful 3-stone trillion setting, and my new fiancé couldn't be happier. Visit adiamore.com/kick and browse their huge selection of diamonds to choose from. You can go on their site and try different diamonds with different settings until you come up with the perfect ring for you or the woman you love. All of Adiamore's diamonds are GIA certified, and their rings have a lifetime guarantee against material defects. Plus, Adiamore even gives you 30 days to evaluate the deal and make sure that you're 100% happy with your purchase. That's because the folks at Adia Moore know that once you find a jeweler you can trust, you've got a jeweler for life, and you'll keep coming back year after year. But hey, don't take it from me. Take a look at the reviews on Yelp. And do yourself a favor. If you're shopping for an engagement ring or a gift, even if you think you're going to buy from another dealer, before you make that big decision, you owe it to yourself to click on adiamoore.com/kick, look at their selection, and compare. That's adiamoore.com/kick. adiamoore.com/kick. Their quality and prices speak for themselves, and my fiancé and I couldn't be happier. And now, back to the podcast. I want to go back for a moment because I just realized that I skipped over probably your most famous film, Rain Man, for which you won a Best Director Oscar. It almost reminds me of the story behind the scenes of Casablanca because, as I understand it, you made it during the writer's strike and you were kind of coming up with much of the story as you were shooting, right?
Yes. Yeah, because we didn't get a chance to get a finished script. And so then we were on location and, you know, things would come up. And so you said, well, what about this? Or how about if we do that? And we were shooting in continuity because we had to go across country. We went from Cincinnati,
yeah,
and we just kept, you know, going west. And so a lot of things began to happen in the course of doing it. So a lot of the scenes were sort of made up as we were just going across country.
Give us an example. What was a moment in Rain Man that you came up with while you were filming?
It's something as simple as, how do you shoot something? It was, you know, they were saying, well, you know, if you wanted to get to L.A., you would just take the interstate. I said, well, the interstate looks so boring. I mean, it looks boring. I mean, it just looks like you could be anywhere, right? And they said, well, if you want to get there, that's the way you got to go. And I said, well, I got an idea. Let's do a scene. There's an accident on the highway, and Raymond won't get back in the car, and he won't go on the interstate anymore because there was an accident.
Yeah.
And know all all the accidents, the number of them, whatever, he's not getting in, he's not getting back in. And that'll get us off the highway, and then we'll have to go across country through the back roads, which look more interesting. And it increased the conflict between, you know, Raymond and his brother, that Charlie can't control him and have him do what he wants to be done, is that he has certain, you know, fears and anxiety. So it actually added to the conflict of the journey by all of these roadblocks that Charlie's going to have to encounter with Raymond as you go across country.
Well, before we get to Paterno, I just want to bring up Wag the Dog because I think it just celebrated its 20th anniversary. Now, there's a movie that has turned out to be downright prophetic, both when it came out and perhaps even more so today. The release of the film happened almost simultaneous to the breaking of the Clinton Lewinsky scandal. How surreal was it for you to watch that unfold in the weeks and months after Wag the Dog opened?
Well, it was very weird, to say the least, because when they showed the picture of, you know, Monica Lewinsky wearing this beret, and we had the, you know, this, this sort of, I think we called her the Firefly Girl, and she was wearing a beret. And there were some reports that said that we had gone back and altered it to put a beret on her head. but we just, that, you know, that was the look we had for the Firefly Girl, that has a beret, you know. So, I mean, so certain kind of similarities and all that stuff sort of swirled around the film in terms of that whole scandal.
Yeah, Wag the Dog has become synonymous with political distraction, and there were definitely comparisons earlier last year when Trump launched the Syrian airstrike amid the Russia scandal. Today, the dog wagger has so many more tools at their disposal than they did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Would you have any interest in making a sequel or an update in the age of social media, fake news, Alex Jones, Breitbart, and the like?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's ripe for somebody to do something like that, you know, the updated version, because the stakes of it just keep rising all the time.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, though, you know, there they came up with these sort of, you know, rather devious plans, you know, but nowadays you just can lie.
Yeah.
You just lie. You just know that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so no one ever thought that you could just lie.
Right.
You know, as opposed to come up with a whole scenario, you know, you don't even have to do that. No, that didn't happen. And or say things that just not even close to credible.
Yeah.
And we are, unfortunately, into a surrealistic time. that I worry about, because I think what happens is when we lose trust in the system, you wonder, well, where do you go from there? If you don't believe in the media, if you don't believe in the press, if you don't believe in your government, where do you go from there? I think we are experiencing the total, complete breakdown of our whole system.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you come back from it. I don't know how you repair it. And if you look to, you know, those in Congress, so few speak up about that deterioration in any way that is informative. I fear for, you know, the future of this country.
Yeah.
I think it's a bigger problem than it's even being seen, because we're just saying we're dealing with incident. But you say, but let's look at the bigger picture. What do you do if you're basically saying the courts aren't working? If none of our systems are functioning correctly, we just can't just meander along and just, you know, hope the stock market keeps going up.
Yeah, and you recently completed a movie for HBO about a very different scandal, Paterno, which I think in some ways, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of indirectly addresses a lot of these issues. Because what I really appreciate about this movie is that it states the facts of the case and leaves some room for nuance. At times, I find myself feeling very sympathetic to Joe Paterno. And at other times, I think, you know, look, if he's such a stand-up guy, why didn't he do more? It's an interesting contrast to how we approach scandals in real time, especially today, where so many Americans are reverting to black and white interpretations of the world. They have no room for nuance, and they just want to put a person in some box that fits conveniently into their worldview.
Exactly. That is a real problem. With Paterno, you try to show that, you know, you have these moments where you're sort of sympathetic to him, and then you go, no, he had it, he didn't. And that to me, that complication of it makes it more fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, because, as you just said, I mean, things are not just simply black and white. And what makes it fascinating, it's one thing if you say, all right, well, all Paterno cared about was winning. If that be the case, you say, all right, now I understand. You know, I now understand why he's going to be part of this cover-up, you know. But he wasn't. He was this man who believed in education. You know, he believed in all of these things and ethics, et cetera. That was what he supposedly talked about all the time.
Yeah.
That's what he was known for. He believed in his football players. 85% of them, you know, graduated. You know, he thought he took pride in all of those things. And you say, well, then how did he get into this situation? And how much did he know, or how much did he not pay attention to? What happened? And it's not just like, oh, well, it's this, end of story. No, it's complicated. And I think what we try to do is also to show his family have to be blindsided by all of a sudden, there's like a media circus outside on the lawn asking questions, and they don't know about anything. So they're asking him. They're just saying, you know, Dad, what happened? They're trying to catch up with the story, which I thought had a dramatic weight to it, and also, in a sense, begins to fill in, you know, these blanks as it goes along. To me, the greatest tragedy is if you can have a sympathy for the character. Because, as opposed to, well, I hate the guy, and et cetera. And you go, okay, I got that. But if you actually have certain sympathy for him, and then you're beginning to hear other things are building on it, and now you're beginning to reevaluate as you're going along, I think that's more interesting. At least that's the take that we pursued.
Throughout this film, you know, I keep thinking he reminds me of a man who's just stuck in another era and operating from an outdated playbook where you don't swear, you don't talk about sex, and you handle delicate matters quietly. He just seems lost in the middle of all this.
Yeah, I think I think in some way it doesn't let him off the hook.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, but, you know, you try to show it with all of the complexity that this man was about. You can't excuse it, and you keep trying to figure out how this all happened. Because he was, as they say, they said that, you know, no one did anything without Paterno, you know, knowing what goes on. He was the emperor of Happy Valley. He knew about aspects and, you know, tried to follow up on it, but he didn't take that other step of, all right, we've got to do this specifically, and you know, let's put this out there. So it's all part of the story.
Yeah. It's a deeply human film in that it acknowledges deep inner conflicts, moral complexities, regret. It made me think of something that you said, I think maybe a couple of years ago, which is that it's getting harder and harder to make movies about human beings. Is Paterno the kind of film that you're talking about? And do you think that a Hollywood studio would have made this version of the story that you wanted to make?
No, they certainly wouldn't. They wouldn't make it. That's the time we're in now. I mean, theatrically, you don't make films about human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like human beings aren't interesting enough, which is what we are. And, you know, in the past, there were all these stories that that were big, popular films about, you know, people and circumstances,
yeah.
And we were caught up in it. But theatrically, we don't do that anymore. So HBO, you know, does that, and Netflix and all the other kind of streaming services are beginning to provide some of that type of filmmaking that is no longer on the big screen. You know, for me, if I'm able to do the film that I'm interested in, and that I can engage an audience, and it's going to be in streaming video or HBO, then that's fine with me. I mean, the irony is, if you take Wizard, and if you were think of it in theatrical
Wizard
terms.
Wizard of Lies?
Yes, Wizard of Lies. If you take it in theatrical terms. So let's just figure, I don't know, what say 12 million people have seen Wizard so far, right? And if you gave it $10, which is what it costs to go to a movie theater, basically, it would have made $120 million. That'd be like a huge hit, a huge hit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and so
big box office.
So that's why those films that I've done, some of these HBOs, so many people can talk about it because the numbers of people who have seen it are very high. You know, there is an audience for it. It's not like no one wants to watch it. It's just it's the change in time. So theatrical is basically more spectacle. And the, you know, HBO streaming video services have a tendency to get some more personal type of filmmaking.
Now, this is, I think, your fourth biopic for HBO, if you count Phil Spector, which you didn't direct, but you executive produced.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that there's a phenomenon with directors who are lucky enough to have a long, successful career like yourself, Spielberg, Scorsese. It seems to me that the older a director gets, the more they're drawn to biographies. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. Although I'm not sure that I would necessarily be drawn to biography. I'm drawn to the story,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the like. If I would say Wizard of Lies, to me it was the real version of Arthur Miller's All My Sons.
Oh yeah, I see that.
Which is very, very much that, you
yeah.
know, a father because of, you know, money and greed, et cetera, you know, made faulty parts for the military, of which soldiers died and one son killed himself out of the shame of it all, you know. And so it has elements of Arthur Miller when I was thinking of Madoff.
Yeah,
so that,
I can see that.
That was sort of in my head. In the end of the day, I'm drawn to stories about people. I do like human stories.
And Al Pacino gives an excellent performance as Joe Paterno. You first worked with him, I think, when you wrote And Justice for All back in, what was that, 79?
Yeah.
How has he changed as an actor since then? Because you've worked with him on a few movies more recently.
Yeah, four or five. He loves the process. He will experiment, try things, you know. It's like, Al, what about if we try this? How about if we do that? You know, he's always up for it. He just loves to act. He's like a guy who just started out with this great desire as opposed to, all right, I'm going to do a film or whatever. I mean, he has such passion about the work that he does.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a terrific time because, you know, I'll throw an idea out to him and rather than going like, well, let me think, I don't know or whatever, you know, we'll say, all right, what about, yeah, okay. And we'll try some things. Some things may not work, and some things suddenly you hit on a moment that maybe leads to another moment. It's fun to play around, because he has such immense talent that, you know, he's up for it, and he's got enormous courage to experiment.
Yeah, he's just terrific in the film. And before we wrap up, I want to talk about one of the more disturbing moments in the film, which is Paterno gets fired and Happy Valley ain't so happy anymore. You have students rioting, setting fires, turning over police cars, all in blind allegiance to Joe Paterno, either oblivious or indifferent to the reality that dozens of children had been raped. When you shot that scene, were you thinking about the tribalism and the anger and the clinging to confirmation bias that's suddenly been so prevalent in our society since the 2016 elections?
Well, you know, what happens is there are two parts to it. One is that there is the emotional component, which is, you know, the students, all they've known about or has ever heard about is that Joe Paterno has been there forever. You know, he is like the father. He's been there forever. So the idea that he's fired, it's like he's fired. And then everybody goes crazy and the kids are, you know, out there and they're demonstrating and turning over cars and setting fires. And it's a pure emotional explosion. Now, there's the reasonable aspect of it that gets lost in that night. You know, when you finally go, oh, wait a minute, let's hold on here for a second. Let's look into this. You know, what are the issues with Paterno? But in that one night of hearing about it, is rational thinking doesn't prevail. And not to condone it, but you understand it. It's like, you know, they've taken away the father. Joe Pa is gone. And it's just a boom, it explodes. And then, you know, in the clear light of the day, you begin to think about it. Now, I don't know what the feelings are in the university now in terms of how they view, you know, Joe Paterno. You know, there are those that are going to have a certain blind allegiance to him because of what they think of him versus what other information that it would apply. But that's all part of us, is that we have a tendency to go one way or the other, is that sometimes we don't really think about it and think it through. We just, boom, we just respond without really taking on what it's all about and the aspects and the complexity of certain things. And whatever reason, as a nation, which is also frightening, is that we are becoming so polarized that we don't even want to hear one another. And that's really dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if you disagree, but you have to be able to talk to one another as opposed to, no, it's not real. It's fake. It's fake. I don't want to hear it. I don't know where we go from here. And I don't know when we were able to have serious discussions from both sides as opposed to this absolutism of extremes.
Yeah, I don't know how we move forward if that's our stance.
That's what I keep trying to think about is, you know, above and beyond it. If we don't believe in anything anymore, I don't know how a nation survives and continues and is able to do the things it needs to do.
Well, given how fiercely protective Paterno loyalists are, have you gotten a lot of backlash for your portrayal of him?
No, but I assume it'll be some, you know, there will be some, even though we tried to, you know, handle this as in a way that, you know, as I say, is not like someone once said to me very early on in the process. So what's your agenda on Paterno? And I said, I don't have an agenda. I'm just trying to tell the story with a certain degree of, you know, humanity to the whole thing and understand the complexities of it all.
Well, it's an excellent film, and it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Barry. Paterno is available on HBO, HBO On Demand, and HBO Go beginning April 7th. Barry Levinson, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Barry Levinson for coming on the podcast. One more time, Paterno is available April 7th on HBO, HBO Go, and HBO On Demand. Folks, if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.